said. Your talk will be a big help. It will open people's eyes. Robert was going to speak about his personal experience of life under fascism. A lot of them say it couldn't happen here, but they're wrong. Robert nodded in grim agreement. Fascism is a lie, but an alluring one. Lloyd's visit to Berlin 3 years ago was vivid in his mind. I often wonder what happened to the old bistro, Robert, he said. I had a letter from a friend, Robert said in a voice full of sadness. None of the old crowd go there anymore. The Macker brothers auctioned off the wine cellar. Now the clientele is mostly middle-ranking cops and bureaucrats. He looked even more pained as he added, They no longer use tablecloths. He changed the subject abruptly. Do you want to go to the Trinity Ball? Most of the colleges held summer dances to celebrate the end of exams. The balls, plus associated parties and picnics, constituted May Week, which illogically took place in June. The Trinity Ball was famously lavish. I'd love to go, but I can't afford it, Lloyd said. Tickets are 2 guineas, aren't they? I've been given one, but you can have it. Several hundred drunk students dancing to a jazz band is actually my idea of hell. Lloyd was tempted, but I haven't got a tailcoat. College balls required white tie and tails. Borrow mine. It'll be too big at the waist, but we're the same height. Then I will. Thank you. Ruby reappeared. Your mother is wonderful, she said to Lloyd. I can't believe she used to be a maid. Robert said, I have known Ethel for more than 20 years. She is truly extraordinary. I can see why you haven't met Miss Wright, Ruby said to Lloyd. You're looking for someone like her, and there aren't many. You're right about the last part, anyway, Lloyd said. There's no one like her. Ruby winced, as if in pain. Lloyd said, What's wrong?
Toothache.
You must go to the dentist. She looked at him as if he had said something stupid, and he realized that on a housemaid's wage she could not afford to pay a dentist. He felt foolish. He went to the door and peeped through to the main hall. Like many non-conformist churches, this was a plain rectangular room with walls painted white. It was a warm day, and the clear glass windows were open. The rows of chairs were full and the audience was waiting expectantly. When Ethel reappeared, Lloyd said, If it's all right with everyone, I'll open the meeting. Then Robert will tell his personal story, and my mother will draw out the political lessons. They all agreed. Ruby, will you keep an eye on the fascists? Let me know if anything happens. Ethel frowned. Is that really necessary? We probably shouldn't trust them to keep their promise. Ruby said, They're meeting a quarter of a mile up the road. I don't mind running in and out. She left by the back door, and Lloyd led the others into the church. There was no stage, but a table and 3 chairs stood at the near end, with a lectern to one side. As Ethel and Robert took their seats, Lloyd went to the lectern. There was a brief round of subdued applause. Fascism is on the march, Lloyd began, and it is dangerously attractive. It gives false hope to the unemployed. It wears a spurious patriotism, as the fascists themselves wear imitation military uniforms. The British government was keen to appease fascist regimes, to Lloyd's dismay. It was a coalition dominated by conservatives, with a few liberals and a sprinkling of renegade Labour ministers who had split with their party. Only a few days after it was re-elected last November, the Foreign Secretary had proposed to yield much of Abyssinia to the conquering Italians and their fascist leader, Benito Mussolini. Worse still, Germany was rearming and aggressive. Just a couple of months ago, Hitler had violated the Versailles Treaty by sending troops into the demilitarized Rhineland, and Lloyd had been horrified to see that no country had been willing to stop him. Any hope he had that fascism might be a temporary aberration had now vanished. Lloyd believed that democratic countries, such as France and Britain, must get ready to fight. But he did not say so in his speech today, for his mother and most of the Labour Party opposed a build-up in British armaments, and hoped the League of Nations would be able to deal with the dictators. They wanted, at all costs, to avoid repeating the dreadful slaughter of the Great War. Lloyd sympathized with that hope, but feared it was not realistic. He was preparing himself for war. He had been an officer cadet at school and, when he came up to Cambridge, he had joined the officer training corps, the only working-class boy and certainly the only Labour Party member to do so. He sat down to muted applause. He was a clear and logical speaker, but he did not have his mother's ability to touch hearts. Not yet, anyway. Robert stepped to the lectern. "I am Austrian," he said. "In the war I was wounded, captured by the Russians, and sent to a prison camp in Siberia. After the Bolsheviks made peace with the Central Powers, the guards opened the gates and told us we were free to go. Getting home was our problem, not theirs. It is a long way from Siberia to Austria, more than 3,000 miles. There was no bus, so I walked." Surprised laughter rippled around the room, with a few appreciative handclaps. Robert had already charmed them, Lloyd saw. Ruby came up to him, looking annoyed, and spoke in his ear. "The fascist just went by. Boy Fitzherbert was driving Mosley to the railway station, and a bunch of hotheads in black shirts were running after the car, cheering." Lloyd frowned. "They promised they wouldn't march. I suppose they'll say that running behind a car doesn't count. What's the difference, I'd like to know? Any violence?" "No. Keep a lookout." Ruby retired. Lloyd was bothered. The fascists had certainly broken the spirit of the agreement, if not the letter. They had appeared on the street in their uniforms, and there had been no counter-demonstration. The socialists were here, inside the church, invisible. All there was to show for their stand was a banner outside the church saying "The Truth About Fascism" in large red letters. Robert was saying, "I am pleased to be here, honored to have been invited to address you, and delighted to see several patrons of Bistro Robert in the audience. However, I must warn you that the story I have to tell is most unpleasant, and indeed gruesome." He related how he and Jörg had been arrested after refusing to sell the Berlin restaurant to a Nazi. He described Jörg as his chef and long-time business partner, saying nothing of their sexual relationship, though the more knowing people in the church probably guessed. The audience became very quiet as he began to describe events in the concentration camp. Lloyd heard gasps of horror when he got to the part where the starving dogs appeared. Robert described the torture of Jörg in a low, clear voice that carried across the room. By the time he came to Jörg's death, several people were weeping. Lloyd himself relived the cruelty and anguish of those moments, and he was possessed by rage against such fools as Boy Fitzherbert, whose infatuation with marching songs and smart uniforms threatened to bring the same torment to England. Robert sat down, and Ethel went to the lectern. As she began to speak, Ruby reappeared, looking furious.
"I told you this wouldn't work," she hissed in Lloyd's ear. "Mosley is gone, but the boys are singing Rule Britannia outside the station."
That certainly was a breach of the agreement, Lloyd thought angrily. Boy had broken his promise. So much for the word of an English gentleman. Ethel was explaining how fascism offered false solutions, simplistically blaming groups such as Jews and communists for complex problems such as unemployment and crime. She made merciless fun of the concept of the triumph of the will, likening the Führer and the Duce to playground bullies. They claimed popular support, but banned all opposition. Lloyd realized that when the fascists returned from the railway station to the center of town, they would have to pass this church. He began to listen to the sounds coming through the open windows. He could hear cars and lorries growling along Hills Road, punctuated now and again by the trill of a bicycle bell or the cry of a child. He thought he heard a distant shout, and it sounded ominously like the noise made by rowdy boys, young enough still to be proud of their deep new voices. He tensed, straining to hear, and there were more shouts. The fascists were marching. Ethel raised her own voice as the bellowing outside got louder. She argued that working people of all kinds needed to band together in trade unions and the Labour Party to build a fairer society step by democratic step, not through the kind of violent upheaval that had gone so badly wrong in communist Russia and Nazi Germany. Ruby re-entered. They're marching up Hell's Road now, she said in a low, urgent murmur. We have to go out there and confront them.
No,
Lloyd whispered. The party made a collective decision. No demonstration. We must stick to that. We must be a disciplined movement. He knew the reference to party discipline would carry weight with her. The fascists were nearby now, raucously chanting. Lloyd guessed there must be 50 or 60. He itched to go out there and face them. Two young men near the back stood up and went to the windows to look out. Ethel urged caution.
Don't react to hooliganism by becoming a hooligan, she said. That will only give the newspapers an excuse to say that one side is as bad as the other.
There was a crash of breaking glass, and a stone came through the window. A woman screamed, and several people got to their feet.
Please remain seated, Ethel said. I expect they will go away in a minute.
She talked on in a calm and reassuring voice. Few people attended to her speech. Everyone was looking backward toward the church door, and listening to the hoots and jeers of the ruffians outside. Lloyd had to struggle to sit still. He looked toward his mother with a neutral expression fixed like a mask on his face. Every bone in his body wanted to rush outside and punch heads. After a minute, the audience quietened somewhat. They returned their attention to Ethel, though still fidgeting and looking back over their shoulders. Ruby muttered, "We're like a pack of rabbits shaking in our burrow while the fox barks outside." Her tone was contemptuous, and Lloyd felt she was right. But his mother's forecast proved true, and no more stones were thrown. The chanting receded.
"Why do the fascists want violence?" Ethel asked rhetorically. "Those out there in Hill's Road may be mere hooligans, but someone is directing them, and their tactics have a purpose. When there is fighting in the streets, they can claim that public order has broken down, and drastic measures are needed to restore the rule of law. Those emergency measures will include banning democratic political parties such as Labour, prohibiting trade union action, and jailing people without trial. People such as us. Peaceful men and women whose only crime is to disagree with the government. Does this sound fantastic to you? Unlikely? Something that could never happen? Well, they used exactly those tactics in Germany, and it worked."
She went on to talk about how fascism should be opposed, in discussion groups, at meetings such as this one, by writing letters to the newspapers, by using every opportunity to alert others to the danger. But even Ethel had trouble making this sound courageous and decisive. Lloyd was cut to the quick by Ruby's talk of rabbits. He felt like a coward. He was so frustrated that he could hardly sit still. Slowly, the atmosphere in the hall returned to normal. Lloyd turned to Ruby.
"The rabbits are safe, anyhow," he said.
"For now," she said. "But the fox will be back."
2.
"If you like a boy, you can let him kiss you on the mouth," said Lindy Westhampton, sitting on the lawn in the sunshine.
"And if you really like him, he can feel your breasts," said her twin sister Lizzie.
"But nothing below the waist. Not until you're engaged."
Daisy was intrigued. She had expected English girls to be inhibited, but she had been wrong. The Westhampton twins were sex mad. Daisy was thrilled to be a guest at Chimley, the country house of Sir Bartholomew Byng Westhampton. It made her feel she had been accepted into English society, but she still had not met the king. She recalled her humiliation at the Buffalo Yacht Club with a sense of shame that was still like a burn on her skin, continuing to give her agonizing pain long after the flame had gone away. But whenever she felt that pain, she thought about how she was going to dance with the king, and she imagined them all, Dot Renshaw, Nora Farquharson, Ursula Duer, poring over her picture in the Buffalo Sentinel, reading every word of the report, envying her, and wishing they could honestly say they had always been her friends. Things had been difficult at first. Daisy had arrived 3 months ago with her mother and her friend Ava. Her father had given them a handful of introductions to people who turned out not to be the creme de la creme of London's social scene. Daisy had begun to regret her overconfident exit from the yacht club ball. What, if it all, came to nothing? But Daisy was determined and resourceful, and she needed no more than a foot in the door. Even at entertainments that were more or less public, such as horse races and operas, she met high-ranking people. She flirted with the men, and she piqued the curiosity of the matrons by letting them know she was rich and single. Many aristocratic English families had been ruined by the Depression, and an American heiress would have been welcome, even if she were not pretty and charming. They liked her accent, they tolerated her holding her fork in her right hand, and they were amused that she could drive a car. In England, men did the driving. Many English girls could ride a horse as well as Daisy, but few looked so pertly assured in the saddle. Some older women still viewed Daisy with suspicion, but she would win them around eventually, she felt sure. Bing Westhampton had been easy to flirt with. An elfin man with a winning smile, he had an eye for a pretty girl, and Daisy knew instinctively that more than his eye would be involved if he got the chance of a twilight fumble in the garden. Clearly, his daughters took after him. The Westhamptons' house party was one of several in Cambridgeshire held to coincide with May Week. The guests included Earl Fitzherbert, known as Fitz, and his wife, Thea. She was Countess Fitzherbert, of course, but she preferred her Russian title of Princess. Their elder son, Boy, was at Trinity College. Princess Bea was one of the social matriarchs who were doubtful about Daisy. Without actually telling a lie, Daisy had let people assume that her father was a Russian nobleman who had lost everything in the revolution, rather than a factory worker who had fled to America one step ahead of the police. But Bea was not taken in. "I can't recall a family called Peshkov in St. Petersburg or Moscow," she had said, hardly pretending to be puzzled. And Daisy had forced herself to smile as if it was of no consequence what the princess could remember. There were three girls the same age as Daisy and Ava, the Westhampton twins plus May Murray, the daughter of a general. The balls went on all night, so everyone slept until midday, but the afternoons were dull. The five girls lazed in the garden or strolled in the woods. Now, sitting up in her hammock, Daisy said, "What can you do after you're engaged?" Lindy said, "You can rub his thing." "Until it squirts," said her sister. May Murray, who was not as daring as the twins, said, "Oh, disgusting." That only encouraged the twins. "Or you can suck it," said Lindy. "They like that best of all." "Stop it," May protested. "You're just making this up." They stopped, having teased May enough. "I'm bored," said Lindy. "What shall we do?" An imp of mischief seized Daisy, and she said, "Let's come down to dinner in men's clothes." She regretted it immediately. A stunt like that could ruin her social career when it had only just got started. Ava's German sense of propriety was upset. "Daisy, you don't mean it." "No," she said. "Silly notion." The twins had their mother's fine blonde hair, not their father's dark curls, but they had inherited his streak of naughtiness, and they both loved the idea. "They'll all be in tailcoats tonight, so we can steal their dinner jackets," said Lindy. "Yes," said her twin. "We'll do it while they're having tea." Daisy saw that it was too late to back out. May Murray said, "We couldn't go to the ball like that." The whole party was to attend the Trinity ball after dinner. "We'll change again before leaving," said Lizzie. May was a timid creature, probably cowed by her military father, and she always went along with whatever the other girls decided. Ava, as the only dissident, was overruled, and the plan went ahead. When the time came to dress for dinner, a maid brought two evening suits into the bedroom Daisy was sharing with Ava. The maid's name was Ruby. Yesterday she had been miserable with toothache, so Daisy had given her the money for a dentist, and she had had the tooth pulled out. Now Ruby was bright-eyed with excitement, toothache forgotten.
"Here you are, ladies," she said.
"Sir Bartholomew should be small enough for you, Miss Peshkov, and Mr. Andrew Fitzherbert's for Miss Rothman." Daisy took off her dress and put on the shirt. Ruby helped her with the unfamiliar studs and cufflinks. Then she climbed into Bing Westhampton's trousers, black with a satin stripe. She tucked her slip in and pulled the suspenders over her shoulders. She felt a bit daring as she buttoned the fly. None of the girls knew how to knot a tie, so the results were distinctly limp. But Daisy came up with the winning touch. Using an eyebrow pencil, she gave herself a mustache.
"It's marvelous," said Ava. "You look even prettier."
Daisy drew side whiskers on Ava's cheeks. The five girls met up in the twins' bedroom. Daisy walked in with a mannish swagger that made the other girls giggle hysterically. May voiced the concern that remained in the back of Daisy's mind.
"I hope we're not going to get into trouble over this."
Lindy said,
"Oh, who cares if we do?"
Daisy decided to forget her misgivings and enjoy herself, and she led the way down to the drawing room. They were the first to arrive, and the room was empty. Repeating something she had heard Boy Fitzherbert say to the butler, Daisy put on a man's voice and drawled,
"Pour me a whiskey, Grimshaw. There's a good chap. This champagne tastes like pears."
The others squealed with shocked laughter. Bing and Fitz came in together. Bing, in his white waistcoat, made Daisy think of a pied wagtail, a cheeky black-and-white bird. Fitz was a good-looking middle-aged man, his dark hair touched with grey. As a result of war wounds, he walked with a slight limp, and one eyelid drooped. But this evidence of his courage in battle only made him more dashing. Fitz saw the girls, looked twice, and said,
"Good God!"
His tone was sternly disapproving. Daisy suffered a moment of sheer panic. Had she spoiled everything? The English could be frightfully straight-laced. Everyone knew that. Would she be asked to leave the house? How terrible that would be. Dot Renshaw and Nora Farquharson would crow if she went home in disgrace. She would rather die. But Bing burst out laughing.
"I say, that's terribly good," he said. "Look at this, Grimshaw."
The elderly butler, coming in with a bottle of champagne and a silver ice bucket, observed them bleakly. In a tone of withering insincerity, he said,
"Most amusing, Sir Bartholomew."
Bing continued to regard them all with a delight mingled with lasciviousness, and Daisy realized, too late, that dressing like the opposite sex might misleadingly suggest, to some men, a degree of sexual freedom and a willingness to experiment, a suggestion that could obviously lead to trouble. As the party assembled for dinner, most of the other guests followed the lead of their host in treating the girls' prank as an amusing piece of tomfoolery, though Daisy could tell they were not all equally charmed. Daisy's mother went pale with fright when she saw them and sat down quickly as if she felt shaky. Princess Bea, a heavily corseted woman in her 40s, who might once have been pretty, wrinkled her powdered brow in a censorious frown. But Lady Westhampton was a jolly woman who reacted to life, as to her wayward husband, with a tolerant smile. She laughed heartily and congratulated Daisy on her mustache. The boys, coming last, were also delighted. General Murray's son, Lieutenant Jimmy Murray, not as straight-laced as his father, roared with pleased laughter. The Fitzherbert sons, Boy and Andy, came in together, and it was Boy's reaction that was the most interesting of all. He stared at the girls with mesmeric fascination. He tried to cover up with jollity, haw-hawing like the other men, but it was clear he was weirdly captivated. At dinner, the twins picked up Daisy's joke and talked like men, in deep voices and hearty tones, making the others laugh. Lindy held up her wine glass and said,
"How do you like this claret, Liz?"
Lizzie replied,
"I think it's a bit thin, old boy. I've a notion Bing's been watering it, don't you know?"
All through dinner, Daisy kept catching boys staring at her. He did not resemble his handsome father, but all the same he was good-looking, with his mother's blue eyes. She began to feel embarrassed, as if he was ogling her breasts. To break the spell, she said,
"And have you been taking exams, boy?"
"Good Lord, no," he said.
His father said, "Too busy flying his plane to study much?" This was phrased as a criticism, but it sounded as if Fitz was actually proud of his elder son. Boy pretended to be outraged.
"A slander," he said.
Ava was mystified.
"Why are you at the university if you don't wish to study?"
Lindy explained. Some of the boys don't bother to graduate, especially if they're not academic types. Lizzie added, especially if they're rich and lazy.
I do study, Boy protested, but I don't intend actually to sit the exams. It's not as if I'm hoping to make a living as a doctor or something.
Boy would inherit one of the largest fortunes in England when Fitz died, and his lucky wife would be Countess Fitzherbert. Daisy said, Wait a minute. Do you really have your own airplane?
Yes, I do. A Hornet Moth. I belong to the University Aero Club. We use a little airfield outside the town.
But that's wonderful. You must take me up.
Daisy's mother said, Oh, dear, no. Boy said to Daisy, Wouldn't you be nervous?
Not a bit.
Then I will take you. He turned to Olga. It's perfectly safe, Mrs. Peshkov. I promise I'll bring her back in one piece. Daisy was thrilled. The conversation moved on to this summer's favorite topic, England's stylish new king, Edward VIII, and his romance with Wallis Simpson, an American woman separated from her second husband. The London newspapers said nothing about it, except to include Mrs. Simpson on lists of guests at royal events. But Daisy's mother got the American papers sent over, and they were full of speculation that Wallis would divorce Mr. Simpson and marry the king.
Completely out of the question, said Fitz severely. The king is the head of the Church of England. He cannot possibly marry a divorcee.
When the ladies retired, leaving the men to port and cigars, the girls hurried to change. Daisy decided to emphasize how very feminine she really was, and chose a ball dress of pink silk, patterned with tiny flowers, that had a matching jacket with puffed short sleeves. Ava wore a dramatically simple black silk gown with no sleeves. In the past year she had lost weight, changed her hair, and learned, under Daisy's tuition, to dress in an unfussy tailored style that flattered her. Ava had become like one of the family, and Olga delighted in buying clothes for her. Daisy regarded her as the sister she never had. It was still light when they all climbed into cars and carriages and drove the 5 miles into the town center. Daisy thought Cambridge was the quaintest place she had ever seen, with its winding little streets and elegant college buildings. They got out at Trinity and Daisy gazed up at the statue of its founder, King Henry VIII. When they passed through the 16th-century brick gatehouse, Daisy gasped with pleasure at the sight that met her eyes, a large quadrangle, its trimmed green lawn crossed by cobbled paths, with an elaborate architectural fountain in the middle. On all four sides, time-worn buildings of golden stone formed the backdrop against which young men in tailcoats danced with gorgeously dressed girls, and dozens of waiters in evening dress offered trays crowded with glasses of champagne. Daisy clapped her hands with joy. This was just the kind of thing she loved. She danced with Boy, then Jimmy Murray, then Bing, who held her close and let his right hand drift from the small of her back down to the swell of her hips. She decided not to protest. The English band played a watery imitation of American jazz, but they were loud and fast, and they knew all the latest hits. Night fell, and the quadrangle was illuminated with blazing torches. Daisy took a break to check on Ava, who was not so self-confident and sometimes needed to be introduced around. However, she need not have worried. She found Ava talking to a strikingly handsome student in a suit too big for him. Ava introduced him as Lloyd Williams.
We've been talking about fascism in Germany, Lloyd said, as if Daisy might want to join in the discussion.
How extraordinarily dull of you, Daisy said.
Lloyd seemed not to hear that.
I was in Berlin 3 years ago, when Hitler came to power. I didn't meet Ava then, but it turned out we have some acquaintances in common.
Jimmy Murray appeared and asked Ava to dance. Lloyd was visibly disappointed to see her go, but summoned his manners and graciously asked Daisy, and they moved closer to the band.
What an interesting person your friend Ava is, he said.
Why, Mr. Williams, that's what every girl longs to hear from her dancing partner, Daisy replied.
As soon as the words were out of her mouth, she regretted sounding shrewish. But he was amused. He grinned and said,
Dear me, you're so right. I am justly reproved. I must try to be more gallant. She immediately liked him better for being able to laugh at himself. It showed confidence. He said, Are you staying at Chimley, like Ava?
Yes.
Then you must be the American who gave Ruby Carter the money for the dentist. How on earth do you know about that? She's a friend of mine. Daisy was surprised. Do many undergraduates befriend housemaids? My goodness, what a snobbish thing to say. My mother was a housemaid before she became a member of Parliament. Daisy felt herself blush. She hated snobbery and often accused others of it, especially in Buffalo. She thought she was totally innocent of such unworthy attitudes. I've got off on the wrong foot with you, haven't I? She said, as the dance came to an end. Not really, he said. You think it's dull to talk about fascism, yet you take a German refugee into your home and even invite her to travel to England with you. You think housemaids have no right to be friends with undergraduates, yet you pay for Ruby to see the dentist. I don't suppose I'll meet another girl half as intriguing as you tonight. I'll take that as a compliment. Here comes your fascist friend, Boy Fitzherbert. Do you want me to scare him off? Daisy sensed that Lloyd would relish the chance of a quarrel with Boy. Certainly not, she said, and turned to smile at Boy. Boy nodded curtly to Lloyd. Evening, Williams. Good evening, said Lloyd. I was disappointed that your fascists marched along Hills Road last Saturday. Ah, yes, Boy said. They got a bit over-enthusiastic. It surprised me when you had given me your word they would not. Daisy saw that Lloyd was angry about this, underneath his mask of cool courtesy. Boy refused to take it seriously. Sorry about that, he said lightly. He turned to Daisy. Come and see the library, he said to her. It's by Christopher Wren. With pleasure, Daisy said. She waved goodbye to Lloyd and let Boy take her arm. Lloyd looked disappointed to see her go, which pleased her. On the west side of the quadrangle, a passage led to a courtyard with a single elegant building at the far end. Daisy admired the cloisters on the ground floor. Boy explained that the books were on the upper floor, because the River Cam was liable to flood. Let's go and look at the river, he said. It's pretty at night. Daisy was 20 years old, and though she was inexperienced, she knew that Boy did not really care for gazing on rivers at night. But she wondered, after his reaction to seeing her in men's clothing, whether he might really prefer boys to girls. She guessed she was about to find out. Do you actually know the king? She asked, as he led her across a second courtyard. Yes, he's more my father's friend, obviously, but he comes to our house sometimes, and he's jolly keen on some of my political ideas, I can tell you. I'd love to meet him. She was sounding naive, she knew, but this was her chance, and she was not going to miss it. They passed through a gateway and emerged onto a smooth lawn sloping down to a narrow walled-in river. This area is called the Backs, Boy said. Most of the elder colleges own the fields on the other side of the water. He put his arm around her waist as they approached a little bridge. His hand moved up, as if accidentally, until his forefinger lay along the underside of her breast. At the far end of the little bridge, two college servants in uniform stood guard, presumably to repel gate crashers. One of the men murmured, Good evening, Viscount Aberowen, and the other smothered a grin. Boy responded with a barely perceptible nod. Daisy wondered how many other girls he had led across this bridge. She knew Boy had a motive for giving her this tour, and sure enough, he stopped in the darkness and put his hands on her shoulders. I say, you look jolly fetching in that outfit at dinner. His voice was throaty with excitement. I'm glad you thought so. She knew the kiss was coming, and she felt aroused at the prospect, but she was not quite ready. She put a hand on his shirt front, palm flat, holding him at a distance. I really want to be presented at the royal court, she said. Is it difficult to arrange? Not difficult at all, he said. Not for my family, at least, and not for someone as pretty as you. He dipped his head eagerly toward hers. She leaned away. Would you do that for me?
Will you fix it for me to be presented?
Of course.
She moved in closer and felt the erection bulging at the front of his trousers.
No,
she thought. He doesn't prefer boys.
Promise,
she said.
I promise,
he said breathlessly.
Thank you,
she said. Then she let him kiss her. 3. The little house in Wellington Row, Aberowen, South Wales, was crowded at 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. Lloyd's grandfather sat at the kitchen table looking proud. On one side he had his son, Billy Williams, a coal miner who had become Member of Parliament for Aberowen. On the other was his grandson, Lloyd, the Cambridge University student. Absent was his daughter, also a Member of Parliament. It was the Williams dynasty. No one here would ever say that. The notion of a dynasty was undemocratic, and these people believed in democracy the way the Pope believed in God. But just the same, Lloyd suspected Grandad was thinking it. Also at the table was Uncle Billy's lifelong friend and agent, Tom Griffiths. Lloyd was honored to sit with such men. Grandad was a veteran of the Miners' Union. Uncle Billy had been court-martialed in 1919 for revealing Britain's secret war against the Bolsheviks. Tom had fought alongside Billy at the Battle of the Somme. This was more impressive than dining with royalty. Lloyd's grandmother, Cara Williams, had served them stewed beef with homemade bread, and now they sat drinking tea and smoking. Friends and neighbors had come in, as they always did when Billy was here, and half a dozen of them stood leaning against the walls, smoking pipes and hand-rolled cigarettes, filling the little kitchen with the smell of men and tobacco. Billy had the short stature and broad shoulders of many miners, but, unlike the others, he was well-dressed, in a navy blue suit with a clean white shirt and a red tie. Lloyd noticed that they all used his first name often, as if to emphasize that he was one of them, empowered by their votes. They called Lloyd Boyo, making it clear they were not over-impressed by a university student, but they addressed Grandad as Mr. Williams. He was the one they truly respected. Through the open back door, Lloyd could see the slag heap from the mine, an ever-growing mountain that had now reached the lane behind the house. Lloyd was spending the summer vacation as a low-paid organizer at a camp for unemployed colliers. Their project was to refurbish the Miners Institute library. Lloyd found the physical work of sanding and painting and building shelves a refreshing change from reading Schiller in German and Molière in French. He enjoyed the banter among the men. He had inherited, from his mother, a love of the Welsh sense of humor. It was great, but it was not fighting fascism. He winced every time he remembered how he had skulked in the Baptist chapel, while Boy Fitzherbert and the other bullies chanted in the street and threw stones through the window. He wished he had gone outside and punched someone. It might have been stupid, but he would have felt better. He thought about it every night before falling asleep. He also thought about Daisy Peshkov in a pink silk jacket with puffed sleeves. He had seen Daisy a second time in May week. He had gone to a recital in the chapel of King's College, because the student in the room next to his at Emmanuel was playing the cello, and Daisy had been in the audience with the Westhamptons. She had been wearing a straw hat with a turned-up brim that made her look like a naughty schoolgirl. He had sought her out afterward and asked her questions about America, where he had never been. He wanted to know about President Roosevelt's administration and whether it had any lessons to teach Britain, but all Daisy talked about was tennis parties and polo matches and yacht clubs. Despite that, he had been captivated by her all over again. He liked her gay chatter all the more because it was punctuated, now and again, by unexpected darts of sarcastic wit. He had said, "I don't want to keep you from your friends. I just wanted to ask about the New Deal." And she had replied, "Oh boy, you really know how to flatter a girl." But then, as they parted, she had said, "Call me when you come to London. Mayfair 2434. Today he had come to his grandparents' house for the midday meal, on his way to the railway station. He had a few days off from the work camp, and he was taking the train to London for a short break. He was vaguely hoping he might run into Daisy, as if London were a little town like Aberowen.
At the camp he was in charge of political education, and he told his grandfather he had organized a series of lectures by left-wing dons from Cambridge. "I'll tell them it's their chance to get out of the ivory tower and meet the working class, and they find it hard to refuse me." Grandar's pale blue eyes looked down his long, sharp nose. "I hope our lads teach them a thing or two about the real world." Lloyd pointed to Tom Griffith's son, standing in the open back door and listening. At 16, Lenny already had the characteristic Griffith shadow of a black beard that never went away, even when his cheeks were freshly shaved. Lenny had an argument with a Marxist lecturer.
"Good for you, Len," said Grandar.
Marxism was popular in South Wales, which was sometimes jokingly called Little Moscow, but Grandar had always been fiercely anti-communist. Lloyd said, "Tell Grandar what you said, Lenny." Lenny grinned and said, "In 1872, the anarchist leader Mikhail Bakunin warned Karl Marx that communists in power would be as oppressive as the aristocracy they replaced. After what has happened in Russia, can you honestly say Bakunin was wrong?" Grandar clapped his hands. A good debating point had always been relished around his kitchen table. Lloyd's grandmother poured him a fresh cup of tea. Cara Williams was grey, lined and bent, like all the women of her age in Aberowen. She asked Lloyd, "Are you courting yet, my lovely?" The men grinned and winked. Lloyd blushed. "Too busy studying, Grandmam." But an image of Daisy Peshkov came into his mind, together with the phone number. Mayfair 2434. His grandmother said, "Who's this Ruby Carter, then?" The men laughed, and Uncle Billy said, "Caught out by you." Lloyd's mother had obviously been talking. "Ruby is membership officer of my local Labour Party in Cambridge, that's all," Lloyd protested. Billy said sarcastically, "Oh, aye, very convincing," and the men laughed again. "You wouldn't want me to go out with Ruby, Grandmam," Lloyd said. "You'd think she wears her clothes too tight."
"She doesn't sound very suitable," Cara said. "You're a university man now. You must set your sights higher."
She was just as snobbish as Daisy, Lloyd perceived. "There's nothing wrong with Ruby Carter," he said, "but I'm not in love with her."
"You must marry an educated woman, a school teacher or a trained nurse."
The trouble was that she was right. Lloyd liked Ruby, but he would never love her. She was pretty enough and intelligent too, and Lloyd was as vulnerable as the next man to a curvy figure, but still he knew she was not right for him. Worse, Grandmam had put her wrinkled old finger precisely on the reason. Ruby's outlook was restricted, her horizons narrow. She was not exciting. Not like Daisy.
"That's enough women's chatter," Grandar said. "Billy, tell us the news from Spain."
"It's bad," said Billy.
All Europe was watching Spain. The left-wing government, elected last February, had suffered an attempted military coup backed by fascists and conservatives. The rebel General Franco had won support from the Catholic Church. The news had struck the rest of the continent like an earthquake. After Germany and Italy, would Spain too fall under the curse of fascism?
"The revolt was botched, as you probably know, and it almost failed," Billy went on. "But Hitler and Mussolini came to the rescue and saved the insurrection by airlifting thousands of rebel troops from North Africa as reinforcements."
Lenny put in, "And the Union saved the government."
"That's true," Billy said. "The government was slow to react, but the trade unions led the way in organizing workers and arming them with weapons they seized from military arsenals, ships, gun shops, and anywhere else they could find them."
Grandar said, "At least someone is fighting back. Until now the fascists have had it all their own way. In the Rhineland and Abyssinia they just walked in and took what they wanted. Thank God for the Spanish people, I say. They've got the guts to say no."
There was a murmur of agreement from the men around the walls. Lloyd again recalled that Saturday afternoon in Cambridge. He, too, had let the fascists have it all their own way. He seethed with frustration.
"But can they win?" said Grandar. "Weapons seem to be the issue now, isn't it?"
"Aye," said Billy.
The Germans and the Italians are supplying the rebels with guns and ammunition, as well as fighter planes and pilots. But no one is helping the elected Spanish government.
And why the bloody hell not? Said Lenny angrily.
Kara looked up from the cooking range. Her dark Mediterranean eyes flashed disapproval, and Lloyd thought he glimpsed the beautiful girl she had once been.
None of that language in my kitchen, she said.
Sorry, Mrs. Williams.
I can tell you the inside story, Billy said, and the men went quiet, listening. The French Prime Minister, Léon Blum, a socialist as you know, was all set to help. He's already got one fascist neighbor, Germany, and the last thing he wants is a fascist regime on his southern border too. Sending arms to the Spanish government would enrage the French right wing, and French Catholic socialists too. But Blum could withstand that, especially if he had British support and could say that arming the government was an international initiative. Grandad said, So what went wrong?
Our government talked him out of it. Blum came to London and our Foreign Secretary, Anthony Eden, told him we would not support him.
Grandad was angered.
Why does he need support? How can a socialist prime minister let himself be bullied by the conservative government of another country?
Because there's a danger of a military coup in France, too, said Billy.
The press there is rabidly right-wing, and they're whipping their own fascists into a frenzy. Blum can fight them off with British support, but perhaps not without.
So it's our conservative government being soft on fascism again.
All those Tories have investments in Spain. Wine, textiles, coal, steel, and they're afraid the left-wing government will expropriate them.
What about America? They believe in democracy. Surely they'll sell guns to Spain.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But there's a well-financed Catholic lobby, led by a millionaire called Joseph Kennedy, opposing any help to the Spanish government, and a democratic president needs Catholic support. Roosevelt won't do anything to jeopardize his New Deal.
Well, there's something we can do, said Lenny Griffiths, and a look of adolescent defiance came over his face.
What's that, Len, boy? Said Billy.
We can go to Spain and fight.
His father said, Don't talk daft, Lenny. Lots of people are talking about going all over the world, even in America. They want to form volunteer units to fight alongside the regular army.
Lloyd sat upright.
Do they?
This was the first he had heard of it.
How do you know?
I read about it in the Daily Herald. Lloyd was electrified. Volunteers going to Spain to fight the fascists. Tom Griffiths said to Lenny,
Well, you're not going, and that's that.
Billy said, Remember those boys who lied about their age to fight in the Great War? Thousands of them.
And totally useless, most of them,
Tom said.
I recall that kid who cried before the Somme.
What was his name, Billy?
Owen Bevin.
He ran away, didn't he?
Aye,
to a firing squad. The bastard shot him for desertion. 15 he was, poor little tyke.
Lenny said, I'm 16.
Aye, said his father. Big difference, that.
Grandad said, Lloyd here is going to miss the train to London in about 10 minutes. Lloyd had been so struck by Lenny's revelation that he had not kept an eye on the clock. He jumped up, kissed his grandmother, and picked up his small suitcase. Lenny said, I'll walk with you to the station. Lloyd said his goodbyes and hurried down the hill. Lenny said nothing, seeming preoccupied. Lloyd was glad not to have to talk. His mind was in turmoil. The train was in. Lloyd bought a third-class ticket to London. As he was about to board, Lenny said,
Tell me now, Lloyd, how do you get a passport?
You're serious about going to Spain, aren't you?
Come on, man, don't muck about. I want to know.
The whistle blew. Lloyd climbed aboard, closed the door and let down the window. You go to the post office and ask for a form, he said. Lenny said despondently, If I went to the Aberdeen post office and asked for a passport form, my mother would hear of it about 30 seconds later.
Then go to Cardiff, said Lloyd, and the train pulled away.
He settled in his seat and took from his pocket a copy of Le Rouge et le Noir by Stendhal in French. He stared at the page without taking anything in. He could think of only one idea: going to Spain. He knew he should be scared, but all he felt was excitement at the prospect of fighting, really fighting, not just holding meetings, against the kind of men who had set the dogs on Jürg. No doubt fear would come later. Before a boxing match he was not scared in the dressing room, but when he entered the ring and saw the man who wanted to beat him unconscious, looked at the muscular shoulders and the hard fists and the vicious face, then his mouth went dry, and his heart pounded, and he had to suppress the impulse to turn and run away. Right now he was mainly worried about his parents. Bernie was so proud of having a stepson at Cambridge. He had told half the East End, and he would be devastated if Lloyd left before getting his degree. Ethel would be frightened that her son might be wounded or killed. They would both be terribly upset. There were other issues. How would he get to Spain? What city would he go to? How would he pay the fare? But only one snag really gave him pause. Daisy Peshkov. He told himself not to be ridiculous. He had met her twice. She was not even very interested in him. That was smart of her, because they were ill-suited. She was a millionaire's daughter and a shallow socialite, who thought talking about politics was dull. She liked men such as Boy Fitzherbert. That alone proved she was wrong for Lloyd. Yet he could not get her out of his mind, and the thought of going to Spain and losing all chance of seeing her again filled him with sadness. Mayfair, 2434. He felt ashamed of his hesitation, especially when he recalled Lenny's simple determination. Lloyd had been talking about fighting fascism for years. Now there was a chance to do it. How could he not go? He reached London's Paddington station, took the tube to Aldgate, and walked to the row house in Nutley Street where he had been born. He let himself in with his own key. The place had not changed much since he was a child, but one innovation was the telephone on a little table next to the hat stand. It was the only phone on the street, and the neighbours treated it as public property. Beside the phone was a box in which they placed the money for their calls. His mother was in the kitchen. She had her hat on, ready to go out to address a Labour Party meeting. What else? But she put the kettle on and made him tea. "How are they all in Aberowyn?" she asked. "Uncle Billy is there this weekend," he said. "All the neighbours came into Grandad's kitchen. It's like a medieval court." "Are your grandparents well?" "Grandad is the same as ever. Grandmam looks older." He paused. "Lenny Griffiths wants to go to Spain to fight the fascists." She pursed her lips in disapproval. "Does he know?" "I'm considering going with him. What do you think?" He was expecting opposition, but even so her reaction surprised him.
"Don't you bloody dare," she said savagely.
She did not share her mother's aversion to swear words.
"Don't even speak of it."
She slammed the teapot down on the kitchen table. "I bore you in pain and suffering, and raised you, and put shoes on your feet, and sent you to school, and I didn't go through all that for you to throw your life away in a bloody war."
He was taken aback. "I wasn't thinking of throwing my life away," he said, "but I might risk it in a cause you brought me up to believe in."
To his astonishment, she began to sob. She rarely cried. In fact, Lloyd could not remember the last time.
"Mother, don't."
He put his arm around her shaking shoulders.
"It hasn't happened yet."
Bernie came into the kitchen, a stocky, middle-aged man with a bald dome.
"What's all this?" he said. He looked a bit scared.
Lloyd said, "I'm sorry, Dad. I've upset her."
He stepped back and let Bernie put his arms around Ethel. She wailed.
"He's going to Spain. He'll be killed."
"Let's all calm down and discuss it sensibly," Bernie said.
He was a sensible man, wearing a sensible dark suit and much-repaired shoes with sensible thick soles. No doubt that was why people voted for him. He was a local politician, representing Aldgate on the London County Council. Lloyd had never known his own father, but he could not imagine loving a real father more than he loved Bernie, who had been a gentle stepfather, quick to comfort and advise, slow to command or punish. He treated Lloyd no differently from his daughter, Millie. Bernie persuaded Ethel to sit at the kitchen table, and Lloyd poured her a cup of tea.
I thought my brother was dead once, Ethel said, her tears still flowing. The telegrams came to Wellington Row, and the wretched boy from the post office had to go from one house to the next, giving men and women the bits of paper that said their sons and husbands were dead. Poor lad. What was his name? Geraint, I think. But he didn't have a telegram for our house, and, wicked woman that I am, I thanked God it was others that had died and not our Billy. You're not a wicked woman, Bernie said, patting her.
Lloyd's half-sister, Millie, appeared from upstairs. She was 16, but looked older, especially dressed as she was this evening, in a stylish black outfit and small gold earrings. For 2 years she had worked in a women's wear shop in Aldgate, but she was bright and ambitious, and in the last few days she had got a job in a swanky West End department store. She looked at Ethel and said,
"Ma'am, what's the matter?"
She spoke with a Cockney accent.
"Your brother wants to go to Spain and get himself killed,"
Ethel cried. Millie looked accusingly at Lloyd.
"What have you been saying to her?"
Millie was always quick to find fault with her older brother, who she felt was undeservedly adored. Lloyd responded with fond tolerance.
"Lenny Griffiths from Aberowen is going to fight the fascists, and I told ma'am I was thinking about going with him." "Trust you," Millie said disgustedly.
"I doubt if you can get there," said Bernie, ever practical. "After all, the country is in the middle of a civil war."
"I can get a train to Marseille. Barcelona's not far from the French border."
80 or 90 miles, and it's a cold walk over the Pyrenees.
There must be ships going from Marseille to Barcelona. It's not so far by sea." "True." "Stop it, Bernie," Ethel cried. "You sound as if you're discussing the quickest way to Piccadilly Circus. He's talking about going to war. I won't allow it."
"He's 21, you know," Bernie said. "We can't stop him."
"I know how bloody old he is."
Bernie looked at his watch. "We need to get to the meeting. You're the main speaker, and Lloyd's not going to Spain tonight."
"How do you know?"
she said. "We might get home and find a note saying he's caught the boat train to Paris."
"I'll tell you what," said Bernie.
"Lloyd, promise your mother you won't go for a month at least. It's not a bad idea anyway. You need to check the lie of the land before you rush off. Set her mind at ease, just temporarily. Then we can talk about it again."
It was a typical Bernie compromise, calculated to let everyone back off without backing down, but Lloyd was reluctant to make a commitment. On the other hand, he probably could not simply jump on a train. He had to find out what arrangements the Spanish government might be making to receive volunteers. Ideally, he would go in company with Lenny and others. He would need visas, foreign currency, a pair of boots.
"All right," he said. "I won't go for a month."
"Promise,"
his mother said.
"I promise."
Ethel became calm. After a minute, she powdered her face and looked more normal. She drank her tea. Then she put her coat on and she and Bernie left.
"Right, I'm off too," said Millie.
"Where are you going?" Lloyd asked her.
"The Gaiety."
It was a music hall in the East End.
"Do they let 16-year-olds in?"
She gave him an arch look.
"Who's 16? Not me. Anyway, Dave's going and he's only 15.
She was speaking of their cousin, David Williams, son of Uncle Billy and Aunt Mildred.
"Well, enjoy yourselves."
She went to the door and came back.
"Just don't get killed in Spain, you stupid sod."
She put her arms around him and hugged him hard, then went out without saying any more. When he heard the front door slam, he went to the phone. He did not have to think to recall the number. He could see Daisy in his mind's eye, turning as she left him, smiling winningly under the straw hat, saying, "Mayfair 2434. He picked up the phone and dialed. What was he going to say?
"You told me to phone, so here I am."
That was feeble. "The truth? I don't admire you at all, but I can't get you off my mind." He should invite her to something, but what? A Labour Party meeting? A man answered, "This is Mrs. Peshkov's residence. Good evening." The deferential tone made Lloyd think he was a butler. No doubt Daisy's mother had rented a London house complete with staff.
This is Lloyd Williams. He wanted to say something that would explain or justify his call, and he added the first thing that came to mind, of Emmanuel College. It meant nothing, but he hoped it sounded impressive. May I speak to Miss Daisy Peshkov?
No, I'm sorry, Professor Williams, said the butler, assuming Lloyd must be a don. They've all gone to the opera.
Of course, Lloyd thought with disappointment. No socialite was home at this time of the evening, especially on a Saturday.
I remember, he lied. She told me she was going, and I forgot. Covent Garden, isn't it?
He held his breath. But the butler was not suspicious.
Yes, sir.
The Magic Flute, I believe.
Thank you.
Lloyd hung up. He went to his room and changed. In the West End, most people wore evening dress, even to go to the cinema. But what would he do when he got there? He could not afford a ticket to the opera, and anyway it would be over soon. He took the tube. The Royal Opera House was incongruously located next to Covent Garden, London's wholesale fruit and vegetable market. The two institutions got along well because they kept different hours. The market opened for business at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, when London's most determined revellers were beginning to head for home, and it closed before the matinee. Lloyd walked past the shuttered stalls of the market and looked through glazed doors into the opera house. Its bright lobby was empty, and he could hear muffled Mozart. He stepped inside. Adopting a careless upper-class manner, he said to an attendant, "What time does the curtain come down?" If he had been wearing his tweed suit, he would probably have been told it was none of his business. But the dinner jacket was the uniform of authority, and the attendant said, "In about 5 minutes, sir." Lloyd nodded curtly. To say thank you would have given him away. He left the building and walked around the block. It was a moment of quiet. In the restaurants, people were ordering coffee. In the cinemas, the big feature was approaching its melodramatic climax. Everything would change soon, and the streets would be thronged with people shouting for taxis, heading to nightclubs, kissing goodbye at bus stops, and hurrying for the last train back to the suburbs. He returned to the opera house and went inside. The orchestra was silent, and the audience was just beginning to emerge. Released from long imprisonment in their seats, they were talking animatedly, praising the singers, criticizing the costumes, and making plans for late suppers. He saw Daisy almost immediately. She was wearing a lavender dress with a little cape of champagne-colored mink over her bare shoulders, and she looked ravishing. She emerged from the auditorium at the head of a small clutch of people her own age. Lloyd was sorry to recognize Boy Fitzherbert beside her, and to see her laugh gaily at something he murmured to her as they stepped down the red-carpeted stairs. Behind her was the interesting German girl, Eva Rothman, escorted by a tall young man in the kind of military evening dress known as a mess kit. Eva recognized Lloyd and smiled, and he spoke to her in German.
"Good evening, Fraulein Rothman. I hope you enjoyed the opera."
"Very much, thank you," she replied in the same language. "I didn't realize you were in the audience."
Boy said amiably, "I say, speak English, you lot." He sounded slightly drunk. He was good-looking in a dissipated way, like a sulkily handsome adolescent, or a pedigree dog that is fed too many scraps. He had a pleasant manner, and probably could be devastatingly charming when he chose. Eva said in English,
"Viscount Aberowen, this is Mr. Williams."
"We know each other," said Boy. "He's at Emma." Daisy said, "Hello, Lloyd. We're going slumming." Lloyd had heard this word before. It meant going to the East End to visit low pubs and watch working-class entertainment, such as dogfights. Boy said, "I bet Williams knows some places." Lloyd hesitated only a fraction of a second. Was he willing to put up with Boy in order to be with Daisy? Of course he was. "As a matter of fact, I do."